Across the River and Into the Trees by Ernest Hemingway.
1. They started 2 hours before daylight, and at first it was not necessary to break the ice across the canal, as other boats had gone on ahead. In each boat in the darkness, so you could not see but only hear him, the poler stood in the stern with his long oar. The shooter sat on a shooting stool fastened to the top of a box that contained his lunch and shells, and the shooter's two or more guns were propped against the load of wooden decoys. Somewhere in each boat there was a sack with one or two live mallard hens, or a hen and a drake, and in each boat there was a dog who shifted and shivered uneasily at the sound of the wings of the ducks that passed overhead in the darkness. 4 of the boats went on up the main canal toward the big lagoon to the north. A 5th boat had already turned off into a side canal. Now the 6th boat turned south into a shallow lagoon, and there was no broken water. It was all ice, new frozen during the sudden windless cold of the night. It was rubbery and bending against the thrust of the boatman's oar. Then it would break as sharply as a pane of glass. But the boat made little forward progress. "Give me an oar," the shooter in the 6th boat said. He stood up and braced himself carefully. He could hear the ducks passing in the darkness and feel the restless lurching of the dog. To the north, he heard the sound of breaking ice from the other boats.
"Be careful," the poler in the stern said. "Don't tip the boat over."
"I'm a boatman, too," the shooter said. He took the long oar the boatman handed him and reversed it so he could hold it by the blade. Holding the blade, he reached forward and punched the handle through the ice. He felt the firm bottom of the shallow lagoon, put his weight on top of the wide oar blade, and holding with both hands and first pulling, then shoving, until the pole hold was well to the stern, he drove the boat ahead to break the ice. The ice broke like sheets of plate glass as the boat drove into it and onto it, and astern the boatman shoved them ahead into the broken passage. After a while, the shooter, who was working hard and steadily and sweating in his heavy clothes, asked the boatman, "Where is the shooting barrel?"
"Over there to the left, in the middle of the next bay."
"Should I turn for it now?"
"As you wish."
"What do you mean, as I wish? You know the water. Is there water to carry us there?"
"The tide is low. Who knows?
It'll be daylight before we get there if we don't hurry." The boatman did not answer. "All right, you surly jerk," the shooter thought to himself. "We're going to get there. We've made 2/3 of the way now, and if you were worried about having to work to break ice to pick up birds, that is altogether too bad." "Get your back in it, jerk," he said in English.
"What?"
the boatman asked in Italian. "I said let's go, it's going to be light." It was daylight before they reached the oaken-staved hogshead sunk in the bottom of the lagoon. It was surrounded by a sloping rim of earth that had been planted with sedge and grass, and the shooter swung carefully up onto this, feeling the frozen grasses break as he stepped on them. The boatman lifted the combination shooting stool and shell box out of the boat and handed it to the shooter, who leaned over and placed it in the bottom of the big barrel. The shooter, wearing his hip boots and an old combat jacket, with a patch on the left shoulder that no one understood, and with the slight light places on the straps where stars had been removed, climbed down into the barrel, and the boatman handed him his 2 guns. He placed them against the wall of the barrel and hung his other shell bag between them, hanging it on 2 hooks built into the wall of the sunken barrel. Then he leaned the guns against each side of the shell bag. "Is there water?" he asked the boatman.
"No water,"
the boatman said. "Can you drink the lagoon water?"
"No, it is unhealthy."
The shooter was thirsty from the hard work of breaking the ice and driving the boat in, and he felt his anger rise, and then held it and said, "Can I help you in the boat to break ice to put out the decoys?"
"No,"
the boatman said, and shoved the boat savagely out onto the thin sheet ice that cracked and ripped as the boat drove up onto it. The boatman commenced smashing at the ice with the blade of his oar, and then started tossing decoys out to the side and behind him.
He's in a beautiful mood, the shooter thought. He's a big brute, too. I worked like a horse coming out here. He just pulled his weight and that's all. What the hell is eating him? This is his trade, isn't it?
He arranged the shooting stool so he would have the maximum swing to left and right, opened a box of shells and filled his pockets, and opened another of the boxes of shells in the shell bag so he could reach into it easily. In front of him, where the lagoon lay glazed in the first light, was the black boat and the tall, heavily built boatman, smashing with his oar at the ice and tossing decoys overboard as though he were ridding himself of something obscene. It was getting lighter now, and the shooter could see the low line of the near point across the lagoon. Beyond that point, he knew there were two other shooting posts, and far beyond it there was more marsh and then the open sea. He loaded both his guns and checked the position of the boat that was putting out decoys. From behind him, he heard the incoming whisper of wings, and he crouched, took hold of his right-hand gun with his right hand as he looked up from under the rim of the barrel, then stood to shoot at the two ducks that were dropping down, their wings set to break, coming down dark in the gray, dim sky, slanting toward the decoys. His head low, he swung the gun on a long slant down, well and ahead of the second duck, then without looking at the result of his shot, he raised the gun smoothly, up ahead and to the left of the other duck that was climbing to the left, and as he pulled, saw it fold in flight and drop among the decoys in the broken ice. He looked to his right and saw the first duck, a black patch on the same ice. He knew he had shot carefully on the first duck, far to the right of where the boat was, and on the second, high out and to the left, letting the duck climb far up and to the left to be sure the boat was out of any line of fire. It was a lovely double, shot exactly as he should have shot, with complete consideration and respect for the position of the boat, and he felt very good as he reloaded.
"Listen," the man in the boat called. "Don't shoot toward the boat."
"I'll be a sad son of a bitch," the shooter said to himself. "I will indeed." "Get your decoys out," he called to the man in the boat. "But get them out fast. I won't shoot until they are all out, except straight overhead." The man in the boat said nothing that could be heard. "I can't figure it," the shooter thought to himself. "He knows the game. He knows I split the work or more coming out. I never shot a safer or more careful duck in my life than that. What's the matter with him? I offered to put the deeks out with him. The hell with him." Out on the right now, the boatman was still chopping angrily at the ice and tossing out the wooden decoys in a hatred that showed in every move he made. "Don't let him spoil it," the shooter told himself. "There won't be much shooting with this ice unless the sun should melt it later on. You probably will only have a few birds, so don't let him spoil it for you. You don't know how many more times you will shoot ducks, and do not let anything spoil it for you." He watched the sky lightening beyond the long point of marsh, and turning in the sunken barrel, he looked out across the frozen lagoon and the marsh and saw the snow-covered mountains a long way off. Low as he was, no foothills showed, and the mountains rose abruptly from the plain. As he looked toward the mountains, he could feel a breeze on his face, and he knew then the wind would come from there, rising with the sun, and that some birds would surely come flying in from the sea when the wind disturbed them. The boatman had finished putting out the decoys. They were in two bunches, one straight ahead and to the left toward where the sun would rise, and the other to the shooter's right. Now he dropped over the hen mallard with her string and anchor, and the calling duck bobbed her head under water, and raising and dipping her head, splashed water onto her back. "Don't you think it would be good to break more ice around the edges?" the shooter called to the boatman. "There's not much water to attract them." The boatman said nothing but commenced to smash at the jagged perimeter of ice with his oar. This ice-breaking was unnecessary, and the boatman knew it. But the shooter did not know it, and he thought, I do not understand him, but I must not let him ruin it. I must keep it entire and not let him do it. Every time you shoot now can be the last shot, and no stupid son of a bitch should be allowed to ruin it. Keep your temper, boy, he told himself. 2. But he was not a boy. He was 50, and a colonel of infantry in the Army of the United States, and to pass a physical examination that he had to take the day before he came down to Venice for this shoot, he had taken enough mannitol hexanitrate to, well, he did not quite know what to pass, he said to himself. The surgeon had been quite skeptical, but he noted the readings after taking them twice. You know, Dick, he said, it isn't indicated, in fact it is definitely contraindicated in increased intraocular and intracranial pressure. I don't know what you're talking about. The shooter, who was not a shooter then except potentially, and was a colonel of infantry in the Army of the United States, reduced from being a general officer, said, I have known you a long time, Colonel, or maybe it just seems a long time, the surgeon told him. It's been a long time, the colonel said. We sound like songwriters, the surgeon said. But don't you ever run into anything or let any spark strike you when you're really souped up on nitroglycerin. They ought to make you drag a chain like a high-octane truck. Wasn't my cardiograph okay? The colonel asked. Your cardiograph was wonderful, Colonel. It could have been that of a man of 25. It might have been that of a boy of 19. Then what are you talking about? The colonel asked. That much mannitol hexanitrate produced a certain amount of nausea sometimes, and he was anxious for the interview to terminate. He was also anxious to lie down and take a Seconal. I ought to write the manual of minor tactics for the heavy pressure platoon, he thought. Wish I could tell him that. Why don't I just throw myself on the mercy of the court? You never do, he told himself. You always plead them non-guilty. How many times have you been hit in the head? The surgeon asked him. You know, the colonel told him. It's in my 201. How many times have you been hit on the head? Oh, Christ. Then he said, you are asking for the army or as my physician? As your physician. You didn't think I'd try to wind your clock, did you? No, Wes, I'm sorry. Just what was it you wanted to know? Concussions. Real ones? Anytime you were cold, I couldn't remember afterwards. Maybe 10, the colonel said, counting polo, give or take 3. You poor old son of a bitch, the surgeon said. Colonel, sir, he added. Can I go now? The colonel asked. Yes, sir, the surgeon said. You're in good shape. Thanks, the colonel said. Want to go on a duck shoot down in the marshes at the mouth of the Tagliamento? Wonderful shoot. Some nice Italian kids I met up at Cortina own it. Is that where they shoot coots? No, they shoot real ducks at this one. Good kids, good shoot. Real ducks, mallard, pintail, widgeon, some geese. Just as good as at home when we were kids. I was kids in 29 and 30. That's the first mean thing I ever heard you say. I didn't mean it like that. I just meant I didn't remember when duck shooting was good. I'm a city boy, too. That's the only goddamn trouble with you, too. I never saw a city boy yet that was worth a damn. You don't mean that, do you, Colonel? Of course not. You know damn well I don't. You're in good shape, Colonel, the surgeon said. I'm sorry I can't go on the shoot. I can't even shoot. Hell, said the colonel. That doesn't make any difference. Neither can anybody else in this army. I'd like to have you around. I'll give you something else to back up what you're using. Is there anything? Not really. They're working on stuff, though. Let 'em work, the colonel said. I think that's a laudable attitude, sir. Go to hell, the colonel said. You sure you don't want to go? I get my ducks at Longchamp on Madison Avenue, the surgeon said. It's air-conditioned in the summer, and it's warm in the winter, and I don't have to get up before first light and wear long-horned underwear. All right, city boy. You'll never know. I never wanted to know, the surgeon said. You're in good shape, Colonel, sir. Thanks, said the colonel, and went out. 3. That was day before yesterday. Yesterday he had driven down from Trieste to Venice along the old road that ran from Monfalcone to Latizana and across the flat country. He had a good driver, and he relaxed completely in the front seat of the car and looked out at all this country he had known when he was a boy. It looks quite differently now, he thought. I suppose it is because the distances are all changed. Everything is much smaller when you're older. Then, too, the roads are better now, and there's no dust. The only times I used to ride through it was in a camion. The rest of the times, we walked. I suppose what I looked for then was patches of shade when we fell out, and wells and farmyards, and ditches, too, he thought. I certainly looked for plenty of ditches. They made a curve and crossed the Tagliamento on a temporary bridge. It was green along the banks, and men were fishing along the far shore where it ran deep. The blown bridge was being repaired with a snarl of riveting hammers, and 800 yards away, the smashed buildings and outbuildings of what was now a ruined country house once built by Longhena showed where the mediums had dropped their loads. Look at it, the driver said. In this country, you find a bridge or a railway station, then go half a mile from it in any direction and you find it like that. I guess the lesson is, the colonel said, don't ever build yourself a country house or a church, or hire Giotto to paint you any frescoes if you've got a church 800 yards away from any bridge. I knew there must be a lesson in it, sir, the driver said. They were past the ruined villa now and onto the straight road with the willows growing by the ditches, still dark with winter, and the fields full of mulberry trees. Ahead, a man was pedaling a bicycle and using both his hands to read a paper. If there are heavies, the lesson ought to say a mile, the driver said. Would that be about right, sir? If it's guided missiles, the colonel said, better make it 250 miles. Better give that cyclist some horn. The driver did, and the man moved over to the side of the road without either looking up or touching his handlebars. As they passed him, the colonel tried to see what paper he was reading, but it was folded over. I guess a man would do better now not to build himself a fine house or a church, or to get... Who did you say it was to paint frescoes? Giotto, I said. But it could be Piero della Francesca or Mantegna. Could be Michelangelo. Do you know a lot about painters, sir? The driver asked. They were on a straight stretch of road now and were making time so that one farm blended, almost blurred, into another farm, and you could only see what was far ahead and moving toward you. Lateral vision was just a condensation of flat, low country in the winter. I'm not sure I like speed, the colonel thought. Bruegel would have been in a hell of a shape if he had to look at the country like this. Painters, he answered the driver. I know quite a little about them, Burnham. I'm Jackson, sir. Burnham's up at the rest center at Cortina. That's a fine place, sir. I'm getting stupid, the colonel said. Excuse me, Jackson. It is a fine place. Good chow, well run. Nobody bothers you. Yes, sir, Jackson agreed. Now, the reason I asked you about painters is these Madonnas. I thought I ought to see some paintings, so I went to that big place in Florence. The Uffizi? The Pitti? Whatever they call it, the biggest one. And I kept looking at those paintings until Madonna started to run out of my ears. I tell you, Colonel, sir, a man who hasn't been checked out on this painting can only see just about so many Madonnas and it gets him. You know my theory? You know how crazy they are about bambinis, and the less they got to eat, the more bambinis they got and that they have coming. Well, I think these painters were probably big bambini lovers like all Italians. I don't know these ones you mentioned just now, so I don't include them in my theory, and you put me straight anyway. But it looks to me like these Madonnas that I really saw plenty of, sir. It looks to me like these just straight ordinary Madonna painters were sort of a manifest, say, of this whole bambini business, if you understand what I mean. plus the fact that they were restricted to religious subjects.
Yes, sir.
Then you think there's something to my theory?
Sure. I think it's a little more complicated, though.
Naturally, sir. It's just my preliminary theory.
Do you have any other theories on art, Jackson?
No, sir. That Bambini theory is as far as I've thought it through. What I wish is, though, they would paint some good pictures of that high country up around the rest center at Cortina.
Titian came from up there, the colonel said. At least they say he did. I went down the valley and saw the house where he was supposed to be born.
Was it much of a place, sir?
Not so much.
Well, if he painted any pictures of that country up around there with those sunset color rocks and the pines and the snow and all the pointed steeples.
Campaniles, the colonel said. Like that one ahead at Kedja. It means bell tower.
Well, if he painted any really good pictures of that country, I'd sure as hell like to trade him out of some of them.
He painted some wonderful women, the colonel said.
If I had a joint or a roadhouse or some sort of an inn, say, I could use one of those, the driver said. But if I brought home a picture of some woman, my old woman would run me from Rawlins to Buffalo. I'd be lucky if I got to Buffalo.
You could give it to the local museum.
All they got in the local museum is arrowheads, war bonnets, scalping knives, different scalps, petrified fish, pipes of peace, photographs of liver-eating Johnston, and the skin of some bad man that they hanged him and some doctor skinned him out. One of those women pictures would be out of place there.
See that next campanile down there across the plain? The colonel said. I'll show you a place down there where we used to fight when I was a kid.
Did you fight here too, sir?
Yeah, the colonel said.
Who had Trieste in that war?
The Krauts. The Austrians, I mean.
Did we ever get it?
Not till the end, when it was over.
Who had Florence and Rome?
We did.
Well, I guess you weren't so damn bad off then.
Sir, the colonel said gently.
I'm sorry, sir, the driver said quickly. I was in the 36th Division, sir.
I've seen the patch.
I was thinking about the Rapido, sir. I didn't mean to be insolent or lacking in respect.
You weren't, the colonel said. You were just thinking about the Rapido. Listen, Jackson, everybody who's soldiered a long time has had their Rapidos, and more than one.
I couldn't take more than one, sir.
The car went through the cheerful town of San Donà di Piave. It was built up and new, but no more ugly than a middle western town, and it was as prosperous and as cheery as Fasalta just up the river is miserable and gloomy, the colonel thought. Did Fasalta never get over the first war?
I never saw it before it was smacked, he thought.
They shelled it badly before the big 15th of June offensive in 18. Then we shelled it really badly before we retook it. He remembered how the attack had taken off from Monastiere, gone through Fornace, and on this winter day he remembered how it had been that summer. A few weeks ago he had gone through Fasalta and had gone out along the sunken road to find the place where he had been hit, out on the riverbank. It was easy to find because of the bend of the river, and where the heavy machine gun post had been, the crater was smoothly grassed. It had been cropped by sheep or goats until it looked like a designed depression in a golf course. The river was slow and a muddy blue here, with reeds along the edges, and the colonel, no one being in sight, squatted low and, looking across the river from the bank where you could never show your head in daylight, relieved himself in the exact place where he had determined by triangulation that he had been badly wounded 30 years before. A poor effort, he said aloud to the river and the riverbank that were heavy with autumn quiet and wet from the fall rains. But my own. He stood up and looked around. There was no one in sight, and he had left the car down the sunken road in front of the last and saddest rebuilt house in Fasalta. Now I'll complete the monument, he said to no one but the dead. And he took an old Solingen clasp knife, such as German poachers carry, from his pocket. It locked on opening, and twirling it, he dug a neat hole in the moist earth. He cleaned the knife on his right combat boot, and then inserted a brown 10,000 lira note in the hole
and tamped it down and put the grass that he had cored out over it. That is 20 years at 500 lira a year for the Medaglia d'Argento al Valore Militare. The VC carries 10 guineas, I believe. The DSC is non-productive. The Silver Star is free. I'll keep the change, he said. It's fine now, he thought. There's merd, money, blood. Look how that grass grows. And the irons in the earth along with Gino's leg, both of Randolfo's legs, and my right kneecap. It's a wonderful monument. It has everything. Fertility, money, blood, and iron. Sounds like a nation. Where fertility, money, blood, and iron is, there is the fatherland. We need coal, though. We ought to get some coal. Then he looked across the river to the rebuilt white house that had once been rubble, and he spat in the river. It was a long spit, and he just made it. I couldn't spit that night nor afterwards for a long time, he said. But I spit good now for a man who doesn't chew. He walked slowly back to where the car was parked. The driver was asleep. Wake up, son, he had said. Turn her around and take that road toward Treviso. We don't need a map on this part. I'll give you the turns. 4. Now, on his way into Venice, keeping strictly controlled and unthinking his great need to be there, the big Buick cleared the last of Sandona and came up onto the bridge over the Piave. They crossed the bridge and were on the Italian side of the river, and he saw the old sunken road again. It was as smooth and undistinguished now as it was all along the river, but he could see the old positions, and now along each side of the straight, flat, canal-bordered road they were making time on were the willows of the two canals that had contained the dead. There had been a great killing at the last of the offensive, and someone, to clear the riverbank positions and the road in the hot weather, had ordered the dead thrown into the canals. Unfortunately, the canal gates were still in the Austrians' hands down the river, and they were closed. So there was little movement to the water, and the dead had stayed there a long time, floating and bloating face up and face down, regardless of nationality, until they had attained colossal proportions. Finally, after organization had been established, labor troops hauled them out at night and buried them close to the road. The colonel looked for added greenness close to the road, but could not note any. However, there were many ducks and geese in the canals, and men were fishing in them all along the road. They dug them all up anyway, the colonel thought, and buried them in that big osario up by Nervesa. We fought along here when I was a kid, the colonel told the driver. It's a goddamn flat country to fight in, the driver said. Did you hold that river? Yes, the colonel said. We held it and lost it and took it back again. There isn't a contour here as far as you can see. That was the trouble, the colonel said. You had to use contours you couldn't see, they were so small, and ditches and houses and canal banks and hedgerows. It was like Normandy, only flatter. I think it must have been something like fighting in Holland. That river sure doesn't look anything like the Rapido. It was a pretty good old river, the colonel said. Up above it had plenty of water then, before all these hydroelectric projects, and it had very deep and tricky channels in the pebbles and shingle when it was shallow. There was a place called the Grave di Papadopoli where it was plenty tricky. He knew how boring any man's war is to any other man, and he stopped talking about it. They always take it personally, he thought. No one is interested in it abstractly except soldiers, and there are not many soldiers. You make them, and the good ones are killed, and above they are always bucking for something so hard they never look or listen. They are always thinking of what they have seen, and while you're talking they are thinking of what they will say and what it may lead to in their advancement or their privilege. There was no sense boring this boy, who for all his combat infantryman badge, his purple heart and the other things he wore, was in no sense a soldier, but only a man placed against his will in uniform who had elected to remain in the army for his own ends. What'd you do in civil life, Jackson? he asked.
I was partners with my brother in a garage in Rawlins, Wyoming, sir.
Are you going back there?
My brother got killed in the Pacific, and the guy who was running the garage was no good, the driver said. We lost what we had put in it.
That's bad, the colonel said.
Goddamn right it's bad, the driver said, and added, sir.
The colonel looked up the road. He knew that if they kept on this road, they would come shortly to the turn that he was waiting for, but he was impatient.
Keep your eyes open and take a left-hand turn on the road leading off this pike, he told the driver.
Do you think those low roads will be good with this big car, sir?
We'll see, the colonel said. Hell, man, it hasn't rained in 3 weeks. I don't trust those side roads in this low country. If we get stuck, I'll haul you out with oxen.
I was only thinking about the car, sir.
Well, think about what I told you and turn off on the first left side road you see if it looks practicable.
That looks like one coming up from the hedges, the driver said.
You're all clear behind. Just pull up ahead of it and I'll go over and have a look.
He stepped out of the car and walked across the wide, hard-surfaced road and looked at the narrow dirt road with a swift-flowing canal beside it and the thick hedge beyond. Beyond the hedge, he saw a low red farmhouse with a big barn. The road was dry. There were not even cart ruts sunk in it. He got back into the car.
It's a boulevard, he said. Quit worrying.
Yes, sir. It's your car, sir.
I know, the colonel said. I'm still paying for it.
Say, Jackson, do you always suffer so much any time you go off a highway onto a secondary road?
No, sir. But there's a lot of difference between a Jeep and a car as low-hung as this.
Do you know the clearance you have on your differential and your body frame on this?
I've got a shovel in the trunk and we've got chains.
What'll you see where we're going after we leave Venice?
Do we go all the way in this car?
I don't know. I'll see.
Think about your fender, sir.
We'll cut off the fenders like the Indians do in Oklahoma. She's over-fendered right now. She's got too much of everything except engine.
Jackson, that's a real engine she's got. 150 ponies.
Certainly is, sir.
It's a great pleasure to drive that big engine on the good roads. That's why I don't want anything to happen to her.
That's very good of you, Jackson. Now just quit suffering.
I'm not suffering, sir.
Good, said the colonel. He was not either, because just then he saw beyond the line of close-bunched brown trees ahead a sail moving along. It was a big red sail raked sharply down from the peak, and it moved slowly behind the trees.
Why should it always move your heart to see a sail moving along through the country? The colonel thought. Why does it move my heart to see the great, slow, pale oxen? Must be the gait as well as the look of them and the size and the color. But a good fine mule or a string of pack mules in good condition moves me too. So does a coyote every time I ever see one, and a wolf, gaited like no other animal, gray and sure of himself, carrying that heavy head and with the hostile eyes.
Ever see any wolves out around Rawlins, Jackson?
No, sir, wolves were gone before my time. They poisoned them out. Plenty coyotes, though.
Do you like coyotes?
I like to hear them nights.
So do I. Better than anything, except seeing a ship sailing along through the country.
There's a boat doing that over there, sir.
On the Sile Canal, the colonel told him. She's a sailing barge going to Venice. This wind is off the mountains now, and she makes it along pretty good.
It's liable to turn really cold tonight if this wind holds, and it ought to bring in plenty ducks.
Turn to your left here, and we'll run along the canal. There's a good road.
They didn't have much duck shooting where I came from, but there was plenty of it in Nebraska along the Platte.
Do you want to shoot where we're going?
I don't believe so, sir. I'm not much of a shot, and I'd rather stay in that sack. It's a Sunday morning, you know.
I know, the colonel said. You can stay in the sack until noon if you want.
I brought my repellent. I ought to sleep okay.
I'm not sure you'll need it, the colonel said. Did you bring any K rations or 10-in-1? They're liable to eat Italian food, you know.
I brought a few cans to help out and a little stuff to give away.
That's good, the colonel said.
He was looking ahead now to see where the canal road joined the main highway again. There he knew that he would see it on a clear day such as this was. Across the marshes, brown as those at the mouths of the Mississippi around Pilottown are in winter, and with their reeds bent by the heavy north wind, he saw the squared tower of the church at Torcello, and the high campanile of Burano beyond it. The sea was a slate blue, and he could see the sails of 12 sailing barges running with the wind for Venice. "I'll have to wait until we cross the Dese River above Noguera to see it perfectly," he thought. "It is strange to remember how we fought back there along the canal that winter to defend it, and we never saw it. Then one time I was back as far as Noguera, and it was clear and cold like today, and I saw it across the water. But I never got into it. It is my city, though, because I fought for it when I was a boy. And now that I am 100 years old, they know I fought for it and am a part owner, and they treat me well." "Do you think that's why they treat you well?" he asked himself. "Maybe," he thought. "Maybe they treat me well because I'm a chicken colonel on the winning side. I don't believe it, though. I hope not, anyway. It is not France," he thought. There you fight your way into a city that you love and are very careful about breaking anything. And then if you have good sense, you are careful not to go back, because you will meet some military characters who will resent your having fought your way in. Vive la France et les pommes de terre frites. Liberté, venalité et stupidité, the great clarté of the French military thinking. They haven't had a military thinker since Dupic. He was a poor bloody colonel, too. Mongin, Maginot, and Gamelin. Take your choice, gentlemen. 3 schools of thought. 1, I hit them on the nose. 2, I hide behind this thing which does not cover my left flank. 3, I hide my head in the sand like an ostrich, confident in the greatness of France as a military power, and then take off. Take off is putting it very cleanly and pleasantly. Sure, he thought, whenever you oversimplify, you become unjust. Remember all the fine ones in the resistance. Remember Foch, both fought and organized, and remember how fine the people were. Remember your good friends and remember your deads. Remember plenty things and your best friends again, and the finest people that you know. Don't be a bitter nor a stupid. And what has that to do with soldiering as a trade? Cut it out, he told himself. You're on a trip to have fun. Jackson, he said, are you happy?
Yes, sir.
Good. Shortly we are coming to a view that I want you to see. You only have to take one look at it. The entire operation will be practically painless. I wonder what he's riding me for now, the driver thought. Just because he was a BG once, he knows everything. If he was any good as a BG, why didn't he hold it? He's been beat up so much he's slug nutty. There's the view, Jackson, the colonel said. Stop her by the side of the road and we'll take a look. The colonel and the driver walked over to the Venice side of the road and looked across the lagoon that was whipped by the strong, cold wind from the mountains that sharpened all the outlines of buildings so that they were geometrically clear. That's Torcello directly opposite us, the colonel pointed. That's where the people lived that were driven off the mainland by the Visigoths. They built that church you see there with the square tower. There were 30,000 people lived there once, and they built that church to honor their lord and to worship him. Then after they built it, the mouth of the Sile River silted up or a big flood changed it, and all that land we came through just now got flooded and started to breed mosquitoes and malaria hit them. They all started to die, so the elders got together and decided they should pull out to a healthy place that would be defensible with boats, and where the Visigoths and the Lombards and the other bandits couldn't get at them, because these bandits had no sea power. The Torcello boys were all great boatmen. So they took the stones of all their houses in barges, like that one we just saw, and they built Venice. He stopped. Am I boring you, Jackson?
No, sir. I had no idea who pioneered Venice.
It was the boys from Torcello. They were very tough, and they had very good taste in building. They came from a little place up the coast called Caorle, but they drew on all the people from the towns and the farms behind when the Visigoths overran them. It was a Torcello boy who was running arms into Alexandria who located the body of St. Mark and smuggled it out under a load of fresh pork so the infidel customs guards wouldn't check him. This boy brought the remains of St. Mark to Venice, and he's their patron saint, and they have a cathedral there to him. But by that time, they were trading so far to the east that the architecture is pretty Byzantine for my taste. They never built any better than at the start there in Torcello. That's Torcello there. It was, indeed. St. Mark's Square is where the pigeons are and where they have that big cathedral that looks sort of like a moving picture palace, isn't it? Right, Jackson. You're on the ball, if that's the way you look at it. Now you look beyond Torcello, you will see the lovely Campanile on Burano that has damn near as much list on it as the Leaning Tower of Pisa. At Burano is a very overpopulated little island where the women make wonderful lace, and the men make bambinis and work daytimes in the glass factories in that next island you see on beyond with the other Campanile, which is Murano. They make wonderful glass daytimes for the rich of all the world, and then they come home on the little vaporetto and make bambinis. Not everyone passes every night with his wife, though. They hunt ducks nights, too, with big punt guns out along the edge of the marshes on this lagoon you're looking across now. All night long on a moonlight night, you hear the shots. He paused. Now, when you look past Murano, you see Venice. That's my town. There's plenty more I could show you, but I think we probably ought to roll now. But take one good look at it. This is where you can see how it all happened. But nobody ever looks at it from here. It's a beautiful view, thank you, sir. Okay, the colonel said. Let's roll.